Matter of State versus Ramirez and State versus Orozco. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honor. Deputy Attorney General Sarah C. Hunt on behalf of the state.
Frank Gennaro on behalf of Mr. Orozco.
Good afternoon, Alyssa Aiello, Assistant Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Raquel Ramirez.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Darcy Babulis Jessic of Pashman Stein Mulder Hayden on behalf of Amicus Curiae, Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, New Jersey.
Thank you. Welcome, counsel. Justice Patterson will be participating in this case. She's going to review the tape of our argument here. Ms. Hunt, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for a rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. Diana was barely 2 years old when she died, and over the course of her final weekend, while in defendant's sole care, she suffered horrendous abuse at the hands of one or both of them. During that time, multiple blunt force traumas left her covered in bruises and cuts on her head, torso, back, and arms. She was also bitten on her face, abdomen, arm, and back by Orozco, her father. And internally, her condition was even worse. She had extensive bleeding in her brain from a very forceful blow to the head, 6 broken ribs, and contusions and bleeding in her lungs, pancreas, spleen, and one of her kidneys. And while she slowly bled to death internally, Diana would have been in agony and growing increasingly stuporous and lethargic and would have been off balance and vomiting before becoming comatose and dying. And while we may not know who struck the fatal blows, either or both of these defendants could have stopped their abuse. And either or both of them could have sought help for Diana after the fact, but neither did. After perpetrating or purposely allowing Diana's merciless beatings, neither one of them did a single thing to help her. And for that, each defendant was properly found guilty. Those convictions were not the result of plain error. The main issue in this case is not whether the accomplice statute requires that an accomplice by omission have the purpose to promote or facilitate the offense. That much is clear from the plain language of the statute. The issue is whether the instruction here adequately conveyed that principle, and it is whether the appellate division's decision misconstrued Bass and incorrectly disapproved of that decision. And the answer to both of those questions is yes. I'd like to address the last question first, because whether or not we ultimately agree on whether the instruction here was adequate, the appellate division's decision is still problematic in its criticism of Bass. And that's for 2 reasons. First, the decision misconstrues Bass as not requiring the state to prove community of purpose for accomplice liability by omission, when Bass expressly acknowledged that requirement and the instruction and analysis in that case accurately stated the law. And second, by criticizing Bass's accurate statement of the law, the appellate division here confused the requirements for accomplice liability by omission by implying there is some other unspecified requirement. But when we look at the accomplice statute and the instruction here, we see that the instruction was sufficient and certainly wasn't plain error. To address briefly why the appellate division should have reviewed for plain error and why this court should apply that standard now, as the appellate division recognized, defendants did not object at trial on the same grounds they raised on appeal, and that simply isn't enough for harmless error review. But in any event, the instruction here was accurate because it provided the standard introduction to the model charge, which is the same language that was used in Bass, and makes clear that the community of purpose is required for accomplice liability by omission. And that requirement was repeated throughout the entire jury charge. And finally, the appellate division here erred in reversing defendants' endangering convictions. First, the state would note that Ramirez has never argued that reversal of the endangering convictions was appropriate, not in the appellate division and not in this court. But even so, the appellate division's reversal of defendants' endangering convictions should itself be reversed. There was no discussion, let alone analysis, supporting reversal of those convictions, and the instruction on one charge in no way affected the instructions on the other. The state therefore asked this court to reverse the appellate division's judgment and reinstate defendants' convictions.
Counsel, are you done with your opening statement at this point?
Yes, thank you.
So I just wanted to follow up on your argument that this charge was accurate. You quoted for us the language of the statute that an accomplice, to be guilty of an accomplice, one must have the purpose of promoting or facilitating the commission of the offense. And that applies to all of the counts in this case, the murder charge and the others, correct?
Well, the accomplice liability really only applied to the murder and the lesser included offenses of that charge here. It wasn't provided during count.
It wasn't provided, say the last part again, I'm sorry.
It was not provided for the endangering count. It was only provided.
Yes. To be sure, all the lesser includeds and the murder charge need to abide by that. If you review the charge at pages 151 and in particular 152 and 153, didn't it deviate from the statutory principle?
Well, no, because that statutory principle was already provided in the standard introduction to the charge. So the jury was aware that the community of purpose was required to be found for accomplice liability by omission, or for accomplice liability under any of the theories, including.
A jury that listened carefully to this charge, take a look at page 152, for example. Those jurors were told that to be an accomplice for murder, one, it was sufficient to act either with purpose or knowledge. To be an accomplice to aggravated manslaughter, it was sufficient if the individual was aware of and recklessly did nothing. For reckless manslaughter, the same. And for an accomplice to aggravated assault, aware of and knowingly did nothing. The specific charges that the judge gave there don't appear to follow the statutory requirement of purpose of promoting or facilitating the commission of the offense. Do you disagree?
Well, when those are read in context with the introduction, with the standard introduction to the charge, I think that does accurately state the law when those are read as a whole, as jury instructions should be.
Can one be convicted based on recklessly doing nothing as an accomplice?
You must do nothing with the purpose to promote or facilitate, and then be reckless with respect to the outcome of the conduct that you have the purpose to promote or facilitate.
It doesn't appear to say that in pages 152 and 53, where you get to the very heart of what the jury is being charged with.
Well, when you look at those specific areas of the charge, it doesn't, but I think when it's read all together in context, in the context of the standard introduction, I don't think there's any ability to be confused about that. And certainly the jury didn't have any questions and didn't come back to the judge with any question as to whether that same community of purpose was required.
Ms. Hunt, let me ask you this question. I am trying to understand why accomplice liability, particularly in a case like this, is required for a manslaughter or an aggravated manslaughter. So I'm going to put my premise and then I want you to respond. We know that as a matter of law, a parent has the obligation to protect the child from harms that can be inflicted by another parent. We've said that, correct?
Yes.
So assume that scenario, which is the one that you have now proposed. We know that manslaughter is a conscious disregard of a known risk. When one parent is watching another parent beat mercilessly a child and has the legal obligation to intervene, why isn't that not a conscious disregard of a known risk that by doing nothing, you are now committing the crime of manslaughter? Put aside accomplice liability. I don't even know why the state was necessarily proceeding. So take what I've said and please respond.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct that in this particular sort of case where it is a parent, accomplice liability isn't necessary. And because conduct does include doing nothing when you have a duty to do something, you could proceed against each defendant as a principal and not only as an accomplice. And I think that really speaks to the fact that even if your honors do find an issue in the accomplice liability charge, ultimately it doesn't have any effect on the convictions because of that exact principle. Because the principle is the same, and a parent can be convicted based on doing nothing.
If what I'm saying is correct, I'm just posing that as a postulate, then the charge on page 50, 152 and 153 is really not, when I'm dealing with aggravated manslaughter, I'm not dealing with murder because that requires purpose. Then it appears that the judge may have properly charged the jury with respect to those two offenses. No? Or, well, your take.
Yes, correct. Those still accurately recite elements of an offense, absolutely. So even putting the accomplice liability aside, if we look at it just purely for whether it accurately states the elements of an offense, it absolutely does, because it does provide the proper mens rea and it does provide what would be required for a parent in that instance to be found guilty.
And, you know, we've tackled before ahead, there have been discussions, we know Judge Pressler, can you aid and abet or like a reckless act? And there may be some circumstances, yes, where you're handing a weapon to someone who's recklessly doing something. But in a situation where a parent has a legal obligation to intervene as a matter of law and is present and doesn't do anything, it doesn't appear that you need accomplice liability. And that's what you're saying?
I think that's absolutely correct. And just to go back to the beginning of that, which is whether you can aid and abet a reckless act, as this court has recognized, that's absolutely possible. And in that instance, the purpose to promote or facilitate from the accomplice liability statute would be with respect to the conduct. And then whatever the individual's mens rea is with respect to the outcome would be what defines the actual offense that they are guilty of.
Who asked for the accomplice liability charge here?
I don't recall that from the record, to be honest. I think it was discussed as early as the charge conference in 7T, which is from March 16th. So I can't speak to which party actually requested it in this instance, but I do know that it was discussed as early as the very first charge conference. So it was an understanding at that point. But I think as Justice Alban pointed out, whether or not there's any error in the, and I don't want to misstate what you've said, but whether there's an error in the accomplice liability charge itself, it's still the final charge does accurately reflect elements of the offenses.
So does that cure a potential problem? I'm looking at page 152, the first few lines, because it's the prelude that sets this up. If you find only one defendant committed the acts causing person's death, the other can be deemed an accomplice, .. if you find, and then it goes on for each one.
So each of these is keyed toward the accomplice charge, not the substantive charge, correct?
Correct. It is. They are each keyed towards the accomplice charge, but in the end, a defendant is found, whether or not it's as an accomplice or as a principal, a defendant is convicted of the substantive offense. They are not convicted of being an accomplice. They're convicted of the substantive offense. It just is by a theory of accomplice liability or as a principal, but ultimately.
For sure, but a conviction under an accomplice theory must satisfy the statute. And I'm simply not following the argument how this does that, how it specifically incorporates the purpose of promoting or facilitating the commission of the offense, other than the earlier reference on a prior part of the charge.
Well, I don't think that earlier reference should be dismissed very easily, because it did immediately precede the recitation of the elements in the context of accomplice liability. And it did make clear that even theory of accomplice liability by omission, that purpose to promote or facilitate is required. So I think to look two pages later and to think that the jury had already forgotten that instruction and forgotten that requirement would not be fair to the jury and would not respect the principle that jury instructions are read as a whole, and especially when the introduction to the charge directly precedes the statement of accomplice, or I guess the statement of accomplice liability. It should all be read together and read in context.
You agree, but look, the state proceeded on theories. Now you're saying, understandably so, that perhaps you didn't have to proceed on accomplice liability for reckless manslaughter and aggravated manslaughter. But the way this was all thrown in here, it became very confusing, particularly when the accomplice liability is given a knowing element too, not just a purposeful. Do you agree that there was at least some confusion created the way this charge was given?
I don't agree that there was any confusion. I think that given how complicated accomplice liability can be when you are reciting elements of multiple offenses, I think that, to be honest, this might be the best way to break it down, to kind of instruct on the, and this is probably why it's in the standard introduction to the accomplice liability charge, to have the most basic principles of accomplice liability laid out first, and then to go into the details of how that would apply with respect to the offenses themselves.
Can I pick up on something, Justice Albin? I think the Chief raised also. Are you agreeing, first of all, that Ms. Ramirez was convicted as an accomplice to Mr. Orozco?
No, we don't know whether either defendant was convicted as an accomplice. It's entirely possible that the jury found that both were principals. Both defendants had admitted to causing, or believed at some point that they had caused the injuries to the child.
That's where I think the confusion comes in, because it seems like the case is being made that one's a principal, one's an accomplice to the other. We don't know which to which, but that argument's made, and then they convict Mr. Orozco essentially as the principal and Ms. Ramirez not as the principal, presumably in response to the proofs that she's an accomplice, but she's convicted of reckless and he's convicted of aggravated manslaughter, two different and separate states of mind. And you can't have that in accomplice liability, can you? And at least not where the principal has a specific intent and the alleged accomplice doesn't have that same specific intent. Certainly with respect to manslaughter or murder.
Well, I don't think that we can know that either one of them was in fact convicted as an accomplice. It's entirely possible that the jury found Orozco guilty of aggravated manslaughter as a principal because of his acknowledgement at one point, of course his story changed, but his acknowledgement at one point that the bite marks might have, or what he referred to as suck marks on the child, were from him, his admission that he would strike the child, not hard enough to throw her across the room, as he said, but that he would sometimes strike her on the head, and she did ultimately die of bleeding in her brain. And then we have Ramirez, who also at one point admits to possibly being the source of the bite marks.
The unfortunate way this was charged is that they both should have probably been just charged as principals, because the failure to act under these circumstances makes apparent a principle that constitutes a conscious disregard of a known risk when one parent is watching another parent brutally beat a child. Am I correct?
Right. I mean, this is a situation where you have two parents alone in an apartment with their child for a weekend. The child is brutally beaten on at least one, probably multiple occasions based on the timing of the injuries. And to say that either parent was not responsible for this death when they have an obligation to not abuse her themselves and to not stop that abuse, I think
that's just in my question, I assume the fact that only the jury could determine, and that is whether or not one parent in fact was present when the other parent abused the child. I mean, that's a, ultimately that's a factual determination to be made by the jury when it's properly charged, correct?
Correct. But I think that knowing that the child was home alone with the parents this entire weekend, and that's when she sustained, I mean, not all of her injuries, she had injuries dating back, you know, long before the weekend as well. Ultimately the injuries that led to her death were sustained over the course of that weekend when she was spent only in their care. And then she, you know, she slowly and painfully died over the course of several hours, maybe 24, maybe 48, the final 6 hours. You know, there, no parent could ignore both the initial abuse or the after effects of that. Either one, any person would be aware of that. Certainly any parent would be aware of the danger to the child and the outcome of that danger here.
Can you elaborate on the failings that you see in the appellate division decision with regard to Bass? You touched on them briefly in your opening statement. If you can just tease that out a little bit more for our understanding.
Absolutely. So I suppose the main problem with the criticism of Bass is that the instruction in Bass and the analysis in Bass was all an accurate statement of the law. The instruction provided there accurately recited the elements of accomplice liability in the context by omission in the context of murder. The court's analysis in Bass made absolutely clear that community of purpose is required for accomplice liability. There was no ambiguity in the Bass decision. So for the appellate division in this case to then one say that Bass incorrectly stated the law. And that Bass did not require a community of purpose to impose those two flaws on the Bass opinion suggests to anyone reading it that that Bass was not an accurate statement of the law, because that's what the appellate division here said was that Bass
didn't the trial court itself in the charge conference see a problem with the Bass opinion and the statutory language that we were dealing with accomplice liability, but felt constrained to follow Bass? Well,
I think there, at some point, everyone was on the same page. Even during the charge conference at 7T on March 16th, the judge.
I'm looking at page 26 of that transcript from March 16th, and that's where it goes on to page 27. But that's what jumped off the page for me as the trial court signaling its discomfort with the Bass instruction.
Well, then I'm looking at page 26 right now, and the judge does say it would seem that under C1 he is required to have the purpose of promoting or facilitating the commission of the offense. Now C1C being the omission section is under C1. So in terms of that, it would seem. Sorry. So in terms of statutory construction, it would be included within C1, that is C1C as part of C1. So the judge did seem to understand that the general requirement of having the purpose to promote or facilitate, because the omission section is underneath that in the statute, that does apply to all three theories of accomplice liability. I think the confusion that may have come about later.
Isn't the theory on murder, it's just wrong. The best, because it has, you could, for accomplice liability, the state of mind has to be purpose. That's what it says. That's what our statute says. And in Bass, and in this case, I'm now talking about the murder accomplice liability. It's the stop, and I'm looking at the Ramirez. With purpose or knowledge that the beatings by the other would result in Sean's death or in serious bodily injury resulting in death. And that's the part, or knowledge. That is not consistent with our statutory accomplice liability charge. And that's where Bass seemed to have gone adrift. And that was the point that the majority was making in Ramirez. Am I correct?
Well, I would respectfully disagree that that is an incorrect statement, because when you're speaking of accomplice liability, the purpose is with respect to the conduct itself. So you would have to have the purpose that the beating occurred, and then for murder, the purpose or knowledge that result in death or serious bodily injury. For manslaughter, you would have to be reckless with respect to the outcome of that. But I think when you look at Bass, when it includes the language about purpose or knowledge that the beatings would result, that is the mens rea of the ultimate offense, not the community of purpose required.
I think, so when you look at murder, this is true of let's take murder. You can be convicted of murder with a purposeful state of mind or a knowledge state of mind. It's purpose or knowledge. That's fine. But our accomplice liability is written differently to make certain some innocent aider and abettor is not convicted. And the drafters of that accomplice liability statute put with purpose. They didn't have a knowledge. They wanted to make certain that the aider and abettor had a purposeful state of mind, and that was the community of purpose. And that's where the knowledge piece does not seem to fit in. From my perspective, looking at this. Now, you can respond.
Well, so I think if you look at that portion of Bass where that details the charge, it says he or she purposely did nothing to stop the beating. That's the accomplice part of it. That's the purpose to be an accomplice to the offense. That's where the community of purpose is communicated, I guess. And then when in kind of the next part of that where it says did nothing with purpose or knowledge, that's where you're getting into the mens rea, the ultimate.
Yeah. No one says that there's a community of knowledge requirement. You said community of purpose. Those words have meaning, community of purpose, not community of knowledge.
Absolutely. And I don't mean to suggest that knowledge alone gets you to accomplice liability. But in the charge in Bass, it is the purposely did nothing to stop. That's the accomplice, that's the community of purpose. Then when you get into purpose or knowledge that the beatings would result, that's where you get to murder. So
let me come back to my question, because I think Justice Albans, I think, is trying to hit on it. When you're talking about accomplice liability, accomplice liability with respect to a principal who commits a murder or an aggravated manslaughter can't be simply a reckless failure to act. It has to be a purpose to kill the child. It has to be a common purpose. And that's what I was trying to get at. You can't have an accomplice to ag manslaughter with a different, you can't have an accomplice to aggravated manslaughter with a different purpose. That purpose, for example, being purposely failing to act. No, it has to be purposely killing the child.
Well, so I
get that right, Barry. Justice Albert, am I kind of on the right track?
I think there's a difference between how you approach it in murder and how you deal with reckless acts.
I agree. No, I'm saying if you're an accomplice to the principal's aggravated manslaughter or murder, you have to have that same purpose, that common purpose, as the principal committing the murder or ag man. And that is the purpose to kill the child. That's different than this reckless manslaughter for which he was convicted, which is outside the accomplice liability charge. That's what's confusing me.
Well, so I think if we look at, I think Bielkowitz kind of lays this out very well. In addressing that for accomplice liability, the community of purpose that's required for accomplice liability is the purpose to promote or facilitate the conduct itself. The what happens it with the outcome of that conduct, whether you intend to kill the child, whether you are just being reckless with respect to the death of the child, that is where you get into what into the specific, I guess, homicide offense that you are guilty of. As long as you have the purpose to, the, you share the community of purpose with respect to the conduct itself, then the mens rea that you have with respect to the outcome of that conduct is what determines your the offense that you're in fact guilty of as an accomplice.
The mens, tell me if I'm mistaken. Let's take murder, because that's the easiest crime that I think to deal with in an aiding and abetting or accomplice liability. It may very well be that the accomplice has to have a higher state of mind, because you can kill someone knowingly and be convicted of murder, but you cannot be convicted as an accomplice unless you acted purposely. Am I correct?
Acted purposely with respect to promoting or facilitating the conduct.
That's right. So even if the person who committed the killing as the principal acted knowingly as defined under the code, the accomplice had to have acted purposely. Am I correct?
Respectfully, I think it's getting confused in the difference between the purpose with respect to the to promoting the conduct itself and the purpose or knowledge with respect to the outcome of that conduct. So an accomplice could have the purpose to promote or facilitate a shooting, a beating, a stabbing, and then only have knowledge with respect to the outcome of that conduct that they had the purpose to promote and still be properly found guilty of murder as an accomplice.
Would you like to briefly address the endangering count?
Yes,
and then wrap I would. Up your argument, please.
Yes, I would, thank you. So just to address the endangering count, I think the appellate division here reversed both of the endangering convictions without any sort of acknowledgement or analysis as to why that was appropriate here. And given that the accomplice liability that was the basis for their reversal of the aggravated and reckless manslaughter convictions had absolutely nothing to do with the endangering conviction, whether there was any error in that accomplice liability charge, with which of course we respectfully disagree with the appellate division on, that error had absolutely no impact on the endangering conviction. So regardless of that error, if there was one, because there was no impact on the endangering conviction, there was no basis to reverse those endangering convictions here. The jury was instructed that the two counts had to be considered separately. And as the trial judge found, the two convictions represent separate offenses, separate crimes with separate elements that that occurred at separate or could have been based on separate conduct. So to reverse the endangering convictions, there was simply no basis for that here. So at the very least, those should be reinstated. And of course, the state would submit that the appellate division erred in reversing the aggravated and reckless manslaughter convictions as well.
Anything else you'd like to add at this point, Ms. Hunt?
No, thank you very much.
Ms. Aiello.
Good afternoon. The accomplice liability statute allows a state to hold a person criminally responsible for a crime that someone else committed. In a homicide case, it permits a person to be found guilty even though they were not the one who raised the gun, pointed it at the victim, and pulled the trigger. Or they were not the one who lost their temper, raised their fists, and inflicted the blows that led to the victim's death. Naturally, a statute that allows a person to be held equally accountable for an offense that was committed by someone else's hand raises the danger of injustice. Not every person who does something that may have facilitated the principal's commission of the offense or failed to prevent the commission of the offense deserves to be held criminally liable for that offense as though they were the one who actually committed it. The way our legislature sought to distinguish between those who deserve to be held liable and those who don't is by looking at whether they had a purposeful mental state. As explained in the commentary to the Law Commission's report that cited in my appellate division's appellate division brief and the appellate division's decision, the three modes of accomplice liability, which includes accomplice by omission, represents an exhaustive description of the ways in which one may purposely enhance the probability that another will commit the crime. There being a purpose, that is, a specific intent to further or facilitate, there is no risk of innocence. The purpose to promote or facilitate is a critical element of all modes of accomplice liability. It is what safeguards against the conviction of an innocent person. Here, not only was that critical element omitted from the accomplice by omission charge, but the jury was affirmatively told that it could find Ms. Ramirez guilty if she were merely aware of the abuse and recklessly did nothing to stop it. The state's argument that the jury would have gleaned from the vague introduction that the judge gave on accomplice liability and from the rest of the charge, which dealt with the other modes of accomplice liability, that a purposeful mental state is required for accomplice by omission as well, is simply untenable. The charge was specifically designed to convey that accomplice by omission is different from aiding and abetting and requires a lesser mental state, because both the judge and prosecutor believe that to be true. At the charge conference, the judge said, the requirement that the accomplice defendant have the purpose to promote or facilitate the offense stands in stark contrast to what is needed to be shown for liability under Bass. Bass liability appears to be available upon a much less significant showing. And the prosecutor agreed, stating accomplice by omission requires only knowing rather than purposeful facilitation of the offense. And the prosecutor repeated that misstatement of the law in summation when he told the jury, by knowingly doing nothing, you are now sharing the same intent as the person who's killing and trying to cause serious bodily injury. It's inconceivable that a charge error of this magnitude did not result in prejudice to Ms. Ramirez, where Ms. Ramirez is not linked to any of the child's injuries. There was no evidence that she was angry or frustrated with the child, and there's no evidence that she had ever harmed the child in the past. While the jury's not required to indicate whether its verdict of guilt was based on principal or accomplice liability, under the facts of this case, there's a strong likelihood that it found Ms. Ramirez liable as an accomplice by omission based on the erroneous charge that the judge gave. Indeed, in summation, the prosecutor made specific reference to Ms. Ramirez when discussing that mode of liability. He told the jury, even if you believe that Raquel had nothing to do with it, didn't lay a hand on the child, if you believe that she was present during the beatings that occurred that weekend and she knowingly did nothing to stop it, she is guilty as well. The error here is clear, the prejudice here is clear, and the appellate division's decision must be affirmed.
Ms. Ayala, can I ask you to address first the endangering charge? We have, whether one agrees with it or not, we have a very carefully written appellate division decision with a good deal of analysis and thought
that focuses on the accomplice charge and potential problems with it. And then there's no discussion that I see with respect to endangering. It may possibly have simply been an oversight.
I don't see how the endangering charge was tainted.
Yes, and I didn't see it either when I didn't raise it, because the judge gave the model charge on endangering and there was no objection to the charge. And I never really considered whether the error in the accomplice charge had the capacity to taint the endangering charge. But I believe that was an error on my part. I mean, in my defense, there aren't a lot of situations where an error in an accomplice charge on one count would affect an otherwise proper charge on another count where the defendant is being charged as a principal. But I do think that this case might be one of them. And I think that there is a basis, and that could be what the appellate division, sensed. And I think that there is a basis, actually, to be concerned that the erroneous accomplice charge did spill over and affect the jury's consideration of endangering, and I'll tell you why. If you think about it, accomplice liability by omission is very similar to principal liability for endangering. Both involve a breach of a parent's legal duty to protect a child from harm, and both allow liability even though the parent was not the one who actually inflicted the harm. So it's very similar in that regard. And even in summation, the prosecutor, you know, remarked that we have these two charges, and really like the biggest difference between them is that for endangering, the state isn't required to prove that a death resulted. So in light of this similarity, I think that the fact that the jury was repeatedly told by both the prosecutor and the judge that accomplice by omission only requires a knowing mental state, which wasn't defined in the context of accomplice by omission. It was just defined as being aware. I think that because, you know, the jury understood, would have understood, because that was made abundantly clear by the prosecutor and the judge, that knowing was the mental state, and knowing is just simply being aware that, and given the similarity between accomplice by omission and endangering, that could very well have affected the jury's ability to apply the definition of knowing, which is very specific and is not just simply being aware. I mean, knowing requires that the defendant be aware of a result, or that that conduct or behavior is practically certain to cause a certain result. I mean, it's very specific. So given the confusion, I think that there really is a very strong possibility that the jury wouldn't have been able to apply that definition the way it was required to.
Is there anything at all wrong with the endangering charge in this case?
Independently, the judge, I don't see an independent basis, because the judge did follow the model charge and, you know, there was no objection. But again, because these two theories of liability, liability as a principal for endangering and liability as an accomplice by omission, is so similar, I think that the confusion over the mental state and the fact that the jury had this idea that just being aware is enough to satisfy the knowing requirement could have definitely affected the jury. I also want to point out something that I didn't notice until recently, that when the judge was charging accomplice liability / shared intent, and that's at page 40 of the judge's written instructions, and I believe that's page 40 of the state's appendix in the appellate division brief, the judge said, since more than one offense is charged, that is murder and endangering, the accomplice status should be considered separately. I know it was just a remark, but that, you know, that could have caused confusion also to the jury. Like, wait, accomplice liability does apply to endangering? It was just such a confusing charge that I think the appellate division was right to believe that endangering was affected by the confusion created by the omission to act.
Ms. Aiello, with so little being said by the appellate division to explain its invalidation of the endangering charge, at the very least, should this court consider asking the appellate division to better explain its reasons for that action? you've postulated a number of theories that maybe were considered, maybe were the basis, but we just don't know because the opinion is silent in explaining its rationale for overturning those convictions.
But I think this court in deciding the harm, in reviewing the capacity for harm that the erroneous accomplice charge had, could make that decision on its own. I mean, that's a decision for the court to make. What capacity for this court to make in reviewing the appellate division's decision that this accomplice charge was erroneous mm-hmm. and was harmful?
The state's asking us to reinstate the conviction.
I'm sorry?
The state is asking us to reinstate the conviction.
If this court finds that there was no basis for concluding that the error in the accomplice charge could have affected the endangering conviction. But what I'm arguing is that even though I had failed to consider it and I didn't argue it below, that there is on this record a real concern. And I'm urging the court to affirm the reversal of the endangering, because I believe that on this record, there is a very serious concern that the error spilled over and tainted the jury's ability to properly apply the knowing mental state that's required for endangering, based on this confusion and based on the similarity between liability under accomplice by omission and liability under endangering.
In any event, both parties seem to be of the mind that the court can address that and decide the issue.
Yes.
Okay. Is there anything, questions? Any other questions, anyone?
I have one question. Do you heard me pose a number of questions to Ms. Hunt about manslaughter and reckless manslaughter. You agree that a parent has an obligation to protect, a legal obligation to protect the child from harms that can be inflicted by another parent. Do you agree with that principle, which is a principle in our law?
Yes, but.
Okay. So my next question is, in a scenario where two parents are present and one is inflicting terrible harm on another parent, the failure to act itself is a conscious disregard of a substantial and unjustifiable risk. Am I mistaken about that?
Under certain circumstances, yes, that's an inference to be drawn, and that would support.
And that would not require accomplice liability. Both parents would be assuming a circumstance where both are present. One inflicting the harm, the other knowledge, watching, also guilty of reckless conduct by not interceding because of the parental obligation.
No, that I disagree with. I don't think that a person can be held responsible as a principal.
Why not?
For failing.
Why not? I'm trying to, if the parent has an affirmative obligation to protect the child, okay, that's an affirmative obligation. And the parent is mutely watching the child be beaten by another person. Why isn't that in itself reckless conduct, given the affirmative legal obligation to intervene?
It would be reckless manslaughter only under a theory of accomplice liability.
Why? I don't understand that. I just don't understand.
Forget
about this case. A parent lets a child run across Route 78, okay? Doesn't throw the kid and watches the child run by, and eventually the child gets struck by a car. No question, that would be reckless. You don't have to be an aider and abettor there, do you? That would be manslaughter. Would you agree? Or no? Maybe you don't.
No, I'm thinking.
Okay.
Right, because it's the parents, because the parent, that parent is allowing, it's that parent's failure to properly supervise the child that makes that parent the principal in that situation. But no, in situations like we have, I'm sorry, is it okay if I?
No, go ahead, explain, because I think you're, go ahead.
Okay, but if we have a situation where the principal is inflicting the injury, there's a father inflicting injury upon the child, and we have a neighbor who can see this, you know, through over the fence of the yard, is watching this, that neighbor has no responsibility to stop the abuse.
Of course.
A parent has that obligation, but that in and of itself, the parent's obligation to stop another person from the principal in that scenario, to stop a principal from committing a crime doesn't automatically result in liability. That just puts them on the same plane as a parent who does something affirmatively to facilitate a beating. Say parents discipline their child by spanking with a paddle or a belt. That's their form of discipline. And in a particular situation, the parent gives the belt to the father or gives the paddle to the father, and then the father loses his temper and starts beating the child wildly. The parent's duty to protect the child, and then the failure to stop a principal from inflicting injury just puts them on the same plane as a person who actually does something, who actually acts by maybe handing the paddle to the father. So that puts them on the same plane. But in both of those scenarios, if the injuries that the father inflicts ultimately result in death, in both of those scenarios, the accomplice parent is not automatically guilty of homicide as an accomplice unless the evidence establishes that the parent had the purpose, the conscious object to injure the child. So if the parent, rather far
afield from the horrific facts that this case has to grapple with. I'm not sure that this dialogue is helping us advance our analysis of this case. Can we come back to the facts of this case?
Yes. I just wanted to address Justice Albin's question as to whether the duty in and of itself, I think
we do understand your position.
Okay. All right. And I think that the problem that Justice Albin was having about a parent, like, why isn't it enough that a parent be held equally liable when they see a child being beaten mercilessly in front of them and they do nothing to stop it? That goes to whether we can infer purpose from the circumstances. So in a case like that, and that's very much the situation in Bass, In Bass, we have a father who was there present. I mean, that's what the opinion indicates, that the father was present as the mother in front of him was beating the child mercilessly. And the father, who presumably had the-
We're familiar with the facts in Bass.
I'm sorry?
We are familiar with the facts in Bass.
Right, so under those circumstances, a jury could reasonably infer that by the very fact that the father didn't intervene when he probably, presumably had like the physical ability to stop the mother, and given the jury could have inferred from that, that his failure to intervene indicated, was indicative that he shared the purpose to harm the child. And that's why he didn't intervene. But this case is very different than Bass. Also in Bass, there was an indication that that father had burned the child before with a cigarette. But in this case, it's very different. This is not, if the jury believed that Ms. Ramirez was present that weekend, but, and was aware that the father was inflicting these injuries, in determining whether that alone, just being present, was indicative of purposefulness, we have to look at all the circumstances. One, this wasn't a situation where we know for a fact that all of these injuries were, that the child was beaten mercilessly in front of her in such a way that no reasonable person would believe that the child was in danger of being killed.
Ms. Ayala?
That's not what the evidence shows.
Ms. Ayala, may I interrupt for just briefly? I understood the focal point of your argument to be there was a problem with the jury charge in this case. And it seems like we're getting a little bit afield from that now.
Oh, I was just addressing the harm and whether we can, I believe that that's what Justice LaVecchia was concerned with, like whether we can infer from the fact that Ms. Ramirez was present on the weekend that these injuries were inflicted, that she had the purpose to facilitate the conduct. And what I was arguing is that this is not a situation like Bass. This is a situation where these injuries were in various stages of healing. We know for a fact that the black eye was caused by trauma that occurred when the child was in the exclusive custody of the father, and he took responsibility for that, and that the laceration on the head could have been caused, the medical testimony was that that laceration could have been caused when the black eye was caused, and that later in the weekend, the child could have suffered a rebleed upon sudden impact caused by maybe shaking or not as significant, you know, impact, maybe hitting the child in the head or shaking the child. And if that was a reasonable inference for the jury to draw, that what Ms. Ramirez saw happening is this father, you know, losing his temper, shaking the child, causing, you know, injuries, superficial injuries, biting. And what she saw was an out of control father and was scared to intervene. And that her failure to intervene was not clearly indicative that she wanted this child to be harmed. It could have been quite the opposite, that she felt, if she said something, that she could have caused the father to become more aggressive, to become angrier. And I think this is not a situation where we know for a fact that all of these injuries were inflicted at the same time during a discrete period of time where the father was enraged and just attacking and beating the child the way the mother did in Bass. That's not the situation that we have here.
What is the remedy that you're seeking now?
For the appellate division's decision to be affirmed.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, that's it.
Are there other questions with respect to the charge? Thank you, Ms. Ayala. Mr. Gennaro.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. The appellate division reversed the convictions in this case due to an accomplice liability instruction that was a clear misstatement of the law based upon the court's misinterpretation of the accomplice liability statute, which led the court to erroneously conclude that 2C2-6C permits a conviction as an accomplice based upon a knowing omission rather than a purposeful omission. The court instructed the jury that you could be an accomplice if you were aware of and recklessly did nothing. The jury on that form of accomplice liability was not instructed on the requirement that there be a purpose to promote or facilitate the commission of a crime. The state agrees that the purpose to promote or facilitate is a necessary, essential element of all types of accomplice liability. And in fact, the statute is unambiguous on this point. This court has upheld that principle on several occasions, and principally in Fair and Whitaker and in Weeks. The state argues, however, that the appellate division in this case was wrong to fault the Bass opinion because, as the state argument goes, if the Bass opinion was sufficient, then this opinion, if the instruction in Bass was sufficient, then the instruction in this case must also be sufficient. But the flaw in the state's argument is that the instruction given in Bass was different than the instruction given in this case. In Bass, the jury was charged that one who purposely did nothing with the purpose or knowledge that it would result in death or serious bodily injury could be an accomplice. And here, for purposes of aggravated manslaughter, the charge was one can be an accomplice if you were aware of and recklessly did nothing. Now, that instruction directly contradicts this court's opinion in State versus Whitaker, where the court says mere knowledge without more does not make an accomplice. Because this instruction was clearly erroneous, the defendant asked this court to affirm the opinion of the appellate division.
Mr. Gennaro, what do you say to the notion that you got an unintended windfall by having the endangering count vacated as well after a thoughtful opinion that focused entirely on accomplice liability, which is not part of the endangering charge?
Well, I'll agree that the appellate division did not say very much other than reversed as to both counts. But my argument goes along the same lines of Ms. Aiello's argument in that the conduct that was at issue to support both the homicide and the endangering was basically the same conduct. So that once the jury was convinced on the first set of counts that a homicide had occurred, it was a very small step to take to say, well, if it's a homicide, it's also endangering. Now, because we don't know how they arrived at their decision on the homicide counts, You know, I think early on that the trial judge had a good instinct that maybe we needed interrogatories here to figure out exactly how they were going to make their decision. The appellate division told them, no, you've got to just charge as in Bass. But I think that there was a danger that if there was a an improper conviction for homicide based upon the faulty accomplice charge, that that could spill over to the endangering count. And I know that Ms. Aiello has mentioned the part of the charge. I don't have it from the, I have it from 9T, which in 9T, it's on page 157. Since more than one offense is charged, that is murder and endangering the welfare of a child, the accomplice status should be considered separately as to each charge. Now, on that point, the state might say, well, it's just a fleeting reference. But then again, the state wants to take the fleeting reference to purposeful conduct and say the jury heard it, they must have followed it. The bottom line is we don't know what they, how they came to their decision. And that is the problem in this case. The state says, well, this charge isn't confusing. And I'll agree with the prosecutor up to a point. On the issue of subsection C, accomplice liability, it's not confusing. The judge explicitly told the jury, you don't have to find a purposeful state of mind. This version or this this variety of accomplice liability requires a lesser standard, and that is clearly wrong.
Well, Mr. Gennaro, under 2C-6, C1, C, and C, a person is an accomplice of another person in the commission of an offense if having a legal duty to prevent the commission of the offense fails to make a proper effort to do so. I've read that correctly?
That's correct.
That doesn't require any purpose, does
it? Well, yes, but the purpose comes in at the section right above it where it says one is a, it's I think it's section one, which is above the A, B, and C.
Okay, with purpose.
It says one is an accomplice if with the purpose of facilitating or committing the crime, and then there are three versions underneath.
Other questions for Mr. Gennaro? Anything you'd like to add?
No, Chief Justice.
Thank you. Ms. Jessic.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I will keep my comments brief as I can appreciate the court's heard from several counsel already. And I'll do my best not to repeat anything, but may it please the court. The issue before you today is really the narrow issue of whether the charge in this case properly conveyed the requirement under our accomplice liability statute. And I think as AG Hunt indicated earlier, everyone agrees that that the accomplice liability statute requires as a necessary predicate that the accomplice act or fail to act for the purpose of promoting or facilitating the offense. And that's under any of the three modes of accomplice liability. So as I said, the narrow question is whether the jury in the case was properly charged, and to the extent the court would consider it, the ancillary question of how this should be charged going forward. We don't have a model charge for this subsection of accomplice liability. Before I get to that, I'd like to just briefly touch on one policy point that I don't know that's been really emphasized today, but I think it goes to the trial judge's understanding of Bass. So there's limited circumstances in which our law is going to hold someone and punish them criminally for a failure to act. Our criminal code assumes, it says it generally assumes a voluntary act. So the presumption is commission. And in the limited circumstances where we will hold someone accountable for a failure to act, and now adding on the layer of for someone else's conduct, the proof to convict someone based on omission would and should require proof equal to, if not more than, aiding and abetting or solicitation. And when I say more than, I mean that the state perhaps has more of a burden to prove purposeful action with purposeful non-action, basically. So there's no logical reading that would suggest, you know, the state could obtain, say, a conviction for murder based on omission on less proof than if the accomplice had actually acted to cause the death. So I think it's an important policy point worth mentioning because it undermines and it puts to rest any suggestion that liability based on omission could require a less culpable mind than any other theory of accomplice liability. And I think that that is somewhat contrary to the trial judge's understanding of Bass. But moving to the other point I wanted to address, as a friend of the court, you know, given that there's been some discussion of the substance of this charge already, is how this community of purpose requirement in the context of liability by omission should be addressed in future cases. So recognizing that we presume jurors have an understanding of charges and consider instructions given to them, the reality is that even the most seasoned attorney, or as this case demonstrates, a very experienced trial judge, would really struggle to grapple with these concepts and the instructions at issue here. So if I'm a juror and I have no legal training and I just heard the prosecutor tell me, you know, well, if the defendant knew about the abuse and did nothing, you know, she can be convicted for murder as well. I think that's a very simple statement and it's very low hanging fruit. And it's going to color the lens of how I, as a juror, then understand the extremely complex legal concepts that are then given by the trial judge. And I think that reality was somewhat recognized by the court in Whitaker, and in which the court described comments like that in summation as the quote was tantalizingly simple but mistaken legal theory. So the jury can easily grasp that, and then, you know, it's going to kind of sort of prime them when they go into the actual instructions given by the trial judge. So our organization is in favor of clear, comprehensible jury instructions, and the charge here really was anything but. It seems like that there's some confusion between the interplay of the community of purpose requirement as it applies to non-purposeful crimes. In other words, how does one intend to facilitate a reckless crime? And that comes back to that important distinction. I believe A.G. Hunt was really was honing on it, and I think we agree there that, you know, there is a distinction for intent with respect to a principal's conduct and intent with respect to the result. And I think that's the mens rea for the underlying substantive crime. I think you have to delineate it that way. Otherwise, you know, it's difficult to have a purposeful action with respect to a reckless crime. So liability based on omission should track the model charge for aiding and abetting and solicitation, not the language of Bass. So where we have a situation where the judge clearly lays out the elements in a sort of numerical fashion, which I think he did so on the latter two theories, which were shared intent and the lesser included offenses in this charge. And you know, specifically said, you know, number one is that the defendant has committed a crime of murder, and that's the principal, or, you know, a lesser included offense. The court's defined those for you already. Number two is that the other defendant, you know, failed to prevent, this is now the accomplice failed to prevent the principal from committing the offense, despite having a legal duty to do so. As has been explained, I don't think legal duty was disputed in this case, but in a case where it is, I think that should be explained to the jury. I think they need to know what's considered a legal duty. Again, not in dispute in this case. Number three, and this is really the crux when you come to this omission, is relating the defendant's inaction to the purpose requirement. So the inaction can't be knowing, it must be purposeful. That needs to be stressed in a charge, and essentially distinguishing, I think, between a situation where the accomplice intends the conduct and intends the result. And I think if that distinction is laid out for the jury, they'll be able to kind of deal with the lesser included offenses. And it's almost a two-step inquiry. One, whether the accomplice intended the conduct to take place. And then second, once that conduct's committed, whether there's the mens rea for the substantive crime. And then finally, the fourth element is assessing that shared intent for the substantive crime versus a possible lesser included offense, which the accomplice could be convicted of. So given the absence of a model charge on accomplice liability by omission, we really believe it's critical for the court to give this type of guidance for a model charge to hopefully be drafted and used and will promote consistency in these types of cases.
I have a question. Do you agree that this community of purpose approach does not work for manslaughter charges? It doesn't work for reckless because the definition of reckless is a conscious disregard of a substantial and unjustifiable risk. It's not purposeful. Do you agree? In these situations, it's really whether one or both of them were reckless. Did they both consciously disregard a substantial and justifiable risk, whether one was beating the child, or the other one was just passively watching it, assuming that the other parent isn't frightened, but has the ability to intervene, just doesn't do anything. It's just a question of whether or not both parents are reckless, not whether or not one was aiding or abetting the other.
And Justice Alvin, I understand and appreciate the point about whether the state needed to even proceed on a theory of accomplice liability in this case, but the fact is it was charged to the jury. So I think—
I understand that, but putting that aside, because we're also talking to the future, how mm-hmm. judges should be charging juries in cases like this. It's not just this case. It's going to be the next case and the case after that.
Absolutely, and that's something.
So what do you have to say on that?
So I agree that it will impact future cases, but I do think that, and I agree with A.G. Hunt on this point, that you can have a situation where an accomplice, or let's just say a person, you know, can intend conduct, but not intend so the conscious disregarding comes sort of after. So they're consciously disregarding the result of what's going to happen when, say, the other parent hits the child or the parent hits the child. I don't intend necessarily for you to kill the child, or that the child, the blow struck to the child would result in death. I do intend, hey, that you hit the child and discipline the child. So I think that's consistent with the Bridges case to some extent, and then also the Belkowitz case, which does make this distinction between intent with respect to conduct and intent with respect to result. So I think having a broad holding that says you can't have accomplice liability for reckless crimes, I don't think we need to go that far, and I don't think the court needs to reach that question. I think it's clear that you can. I think you can have that type of purposeful intent with respect to conduct and not necessarily a result.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, that's it. Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks
for the question. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hunt, did you want to offer a rebuttal?
Yes, thank you. I'll keep it very brief. I just have 3 points to make. The first one is about the homicide charges and the defense's statement that there's no evidence about who was home and when the child was injured. I think, you know, while we might not have that specific sort of information in this case, I think this really comes down to an understanding that or a recognition that Ramirez herself thought that she had caused the bite marks. That the defendants coordinated and changed their stories multiple times, that nobody got help for the child, that, and all of this I think could obviously very easily be read by a jury as being evidence that both parents were involved here. And second, with respect to the endangering charge, I apologize, I can't remember which defense counsel noted it, but the model charge was given here, including the full discussion of the mens rea that's required being knowledge for endangering. And as to the single reference that was made on page 157 about the accomplice status being considered separately as to each charge, the state would just note that that endangering was never detailed in any of the accomplice liability charges. It was not provided as a lesser included. It was not addressed separately. Of course, the judge had already instructed the jury that both counts had to be considered separately. And then only after kind of the charges related to the homicide count were fully addressed was the jury then instructed on the endangering count. And they were properly instructed on that count. So with that, unless the court has any other questions, the state would just ask that the appellate division be reversed.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hunt. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement.